The Big Red Bench.
Game on.
Saturday and Sunday from 6 p.m.
The Joanna Reardon Podcast. A Big Red Bench production for Cork's Red FM.
So next up on the Joanna Reardon Podcast, we have Mara Trasany Kealaigh. Mara Trasany Kealaigh is a Galway woman, but we won't hold that against her. Apparently, according to her CV, she's a Pilates instructor, a fluent Irish speaker, a sport, exercise and performance psychologist, and she's currently studying a degree in medicine. As her side gig, she's also working with Off the Ball, RTE, Air Sport and everything in between. Mara, great to have you.
Thanks for having me. I'll ignore the Galway D. Straight in. That's so Cork, Joanne. Just straight in. Straight for the D. Do you notice I'm wearing my Galway colours?
I noticed, yeah. I felt Joe Kenning was going to appear behind you with the maroon.
Poor Joseph.
Poor Joe. Is he well?
I hope so.
To be honest, he's the only man that's ever made me cry.
How do you make you cry?
Because he won the All-Ireland. I was actually so chuffed for him. I was like, oh my God, this is the best day ever. My great ever Joe Kenning story was, I met him outside Thurles and he went for a handshake. Realised what he had done, slid along my shoulder and patted me on the back and told me I was great. I was like, best day of my life.
That is a slick move. And that's why Joe Canning was Hurler of the Year. He can react to situations quicker than
everyone
else.
Even my mother was impressed. She was like, damn. Hot damn.
Yeah, you know what? I don't know him well at all. Obviously, I'm from the same county as him and I've met him, but I only ever meet him at press events. And I'm sure that's not the real Joe Canning, but he seems so lovely, doesn't he?
He does.
And he just seems really genuine. He comes from a lovely family and they're just lovely people. And you just...
Well, you're a Meehan woman, aren't you? Like, you're obsessed with the Meehan brothers.
I'm obsessed with anyone who played well for Galway, to be honest. I'm not fussy. Like, she did a thing with Off the Ball a few weeks ago with the Meehan brothers. We had three of the Meehans. There's 9 million of them. We had three in.
I recommend everyone watches it because literally Mara looks like she's met George Clooney.
I do. Yeah. I even tweeted out a picture saying, find somebody who looks at you the way I look at the Meehans, because it was just pure adulation and admiration. And like when you're growing up and you see those people and they're your heroes.
Yeah.
And like I think it's because they're from your own county, and then all of a sudden you're a grown up, and all of a sudden you're on stage interviewing them, and they're dancing to your tune. It's the maddest feeling, and you kind of find yourself thinking back to, God, that 15-year-old me.
Yeah.
Did they ever realise or ever think that this would ever be possible? That 15-year-old me who was in my Galway jersey waiting for Sam Maguire to come home to Carrow at 3 o'clock in the morning in 1998. Would I ever imagine that I'd be interviewing a Meehan of all people?
I know, but even in general, like when we first met, it was at a Micheál and Murray Hurtig event, and that was when we would have grown up like idolising, you know. Yeah. And here's the two of us sitting away in between like Bomber Liston, you know, Kieran Donahue, like all the top stars. Like, it's mad where the journalistic job like takes you.
And it's mad that they let two Ediths like us in, isn't it?
We attacked Micheál Donahue that night and told him he was our hero.
That's right, yeah, we found Micheál Donahue at the end of the night as well, where he kind of looked a bit afraid of us, I think.
He did. I felt really, really sorry for him. Take me back, I suppose, when you were growing up in Galway. Did you ever play sport? Like, what kind of got you into sport? And I suppose, what dragged you down the crazy route that you have gone down so far?
Oh, it's a good question. I think, like lots of girls at the time, I was probably the last generation where girls' sport was an afterthought. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know any different. So we went outside, we kicked a football when it was available. A lot of the times the boys we brought out to play football, we were left inside, and that was the way it was. And I remember trying to argue it, but not really getting very far. But any time, like the secondary school I went to had a great soccer team. The primary school I went to was mad into basketball. So we were always active. Mm. But actually the club I was from was in Hiararua. They didn't have a ladies' football team at all. So you had two choices. You could not play football, or you could play for the arch rivals, Letiremud.
Oh, God.
I just wasn't going to do that. Also, I probably wasn't good enough, and I'd hate, be bad enough to play for Letiremud, but even worse to be on the subs bench for Letiremud.
And be told you're not good enough to play for them.
Exactly. So I took the, you know, I'm very patriotic, I'm going to stick in my club. So eventually, Caro did set up our first ladies football club. So I was on that team for a few years. I mean, we were abysmal. Of course we were brand new.
Yep.
But we were improving bit by bit. And then I took a job with Nuacht TG Cahir, which kind of then killed any hope I ever had of really playing football properly, because the travelling you were doing, that kind of stuff. So I kind of fell away from the football. And then actually, funnily enough, when I moved to Dublin then to work for RTE, I joined Na Gaeilge Óga, which is a cool club based out of Lucan and the Phoenix Park. And the whole point of Na Gaeilge Óga is it's a football club and a hurling club and a camogie club and ladies football club, all done through the medium of Irish.
Cool.
So I went there to meet other people, Irish speakers up there, make friends. And it was all either Dubs or other expats who'd moved to Dublin. And the one thing we had in common was we all love sport and we all wanted to speak Irish.
That's kind of cool though, like, because you're in a new city, like you don't know what you're doing. And I suppose you want to keep that Irishness like to you too. Like,
exactly. Yeah. And you find people who are on your wavelength, and you know, you find people who automatically want to help you out because you're part of their tribe automatically. And you're also helping create this new generation of young little hurlers and footballers, because they have a whole thing going on out in Lucan where we're bringing in kids under fours, under fives, under sixes, under sevens, and it's all done as Gaeilge. So in about a generation's time, we're definitely going to see in the Gaeloga have a huge influence on Dublin hurling and football. Like, you're already seeing the Irish language influence, like with Coola, for example, in the hurling. And that's from all the great work done by teachers in Skull Lurkon and Coolosh the Owen, for example. And that's just going to spread now with the Gaeloga. So that's really exciting. So I joined them and played with them up until last year, where again, just kind of life, career, and also old age of two bad knees, all that kind of stuff. I got to the point where whenever I went playing, I never knew if I'd be out for 5 minutes, 15 minutes, 5 seconds until the knees start cracking up. And I was missing loads of training because I was a terrible footballer, but I loved it.
Yeah.
And isn't that the best thing about sport?
It is. You know? Really, really is. Like, it doesn't, like, it. I think I read somewhere recently, I think it was actually at the Women's World Cup, and someone said, systems are great, but happiness is where it's at.
Exactly. And I think happiness, and it might be the same in Cork as well, but I know in Dublin, there's so many different levels because there's so many people up there, which is great, and there's so many teams. So you will find a level for you, even if it is junior F. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. If you're going out and enjoying yourself and getting your run out and not being hurt and not hurting anyone, I mean, that's great. And if you can keep people going, and I think that's the huge advantage maybe the urban centres have now on the rural areas, that rural, you're either senior or you're not, for example. But in Dublin, you'll find a game or a sport or a level that suits you. So I'm kind of half thinking now, I'm going to retake up now some sports, because I'd hoped to join some in RCSI this year and I went back studying, but just the amount of study I had to do was overwhelming because I decided to start a science degree with no science background. So all my spare time was taken up with trying not to fail.
Yeah.
So hopefully next year now I might be able to tie up the old runners.
But you're doing medicine. You're doing medicine now, aren't you?
Like, that's
so,
my point.
Like,
yeah.
What randomly took you to medicine? I know I'm hopping here a little bit, but I
don't know. I knew I wanted to do something and there was a bit of an itch.
Yeah.
I don't know how to describe it. And I went back to UL a few years ago and I did a master's in sport exercise and performance psychology and I loved that. And then I was working away toward my Irish Sports Institute accreditation. And I was going to do a PhD in it.
But?
And that would take around 4 years.
Yeah.
And I loved it. But there was just something saying, do you know, God, you could do graduate medicine and be a doctor in 4 years and not a Ross Geller doctor.
Yeah.
And I just had an itch. I said to myself, because I found as well, I haven't done as much sports psych consultancy as I'd like because of the study, because of the nature of the work I do. I don't think it's fair to be doing sports psych with you and then potentially interviewing you. So I've done enough to kind of keep myself ticking over and keep my training going and that kind of stuff. But I found even in those situations that I'd be talking to athletes, usually athletes, and they'd need something extra.
Yeah.
Be that maybe some extra, maybe psychiatric support, bit of psychological support, bit of anxiety support. And a lot of the time they just needed their sleep and that kind of stuff. And sometimes some of them did need medication, or at the very least, they needed to talk to somebody who was more qualified than me.
Yeah.
And I would tell them, go and talk to your GP.
Or did they find it easy to talk to you though, because you were a sporting kind of person?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But the trouble was, again, this is where sometimes the lines of sports psychology gets kind of blurred. And if people aren't qualified, they can make these mistakes inadvertently. Like, I know what I can and can't do.
Mm.
And I could tell sometimes you need to go to your GP because you might need medication or you might need further advice or further counselling. And then these people would do one of two things. They'd either say, you're crazy and leave and I'd never see them again. Or I might bump into them 6 months later. Did you go? And they're worse.
Yeah.
And they hadn't gone to their GP, or they've left it to the worst possible feeling. And then they've gone and they've maybe lost a year of where they could have been getting proactive work. Mm. That's not their fault. It's just the culture isn't there.
Yeah.
So
that's what I was just about to say. It's more hard now for athletes, isn't it, to come out? Like, it's a bit like, I think, was it that the NBA was on and the draftees were like crying and someone commented, that's not manly. That's not what we want in the NBA.
And exactly. Like, that's, and like, everybody cries.
Yeah.
We all cry. And I think girls are allowed to cry and boys aren't. And I think that's so damaging to boys. And we talk a lot about toxic masculinity and boys are bad and men are bad. And most men aren't bad. In fact, the vast majority aren't. But I kind of feel sorry for them because the only time they're allowed to be seen cry is at a football game.
Yeah.
You know, that's the only time, that is the only time it's acceptable to express emotion now for a man. Whereas a woman's allowed to cry after a bad day. And I think possibly that's why, on the whole, I know it's a broad sweeping generalisation, but I think that's why in general, women tend to be more in tune with their feelings and better able to deal with stuff when bad stuff crops up than men, because men just don't know how.
Yeah. Well, the same in criminology, whenever we're learning about why men would react to specific things, it'd be like a power or just a release of emotions more than anything else. Like, it was, I always thought it was really fascinating. But just, I suppose, going back even to the psychology behind it, because I'm highly interested in like the sports psychology and all that. What kind of drew you to that in the first place? Was because you were meeting athletes all the time? Like, are you like me? Are you just nosy? You're so interested in wanting.
I'm so nosy.
You want to know what makes people tick, you know?
I'm so nosy. But my undergrad degree was Irish and psychology.
Okay.
So I always said I was going to do something with the psychology, but I wasn't sure what, you know. I knew I didn't want to go down the clinical psychology route. And I just started working. And then I found myself reading newspaper articles, listening to people pundits, analysts, so-called experts, people saying, you know, the psychological warfare and all this kind of stuff. I'm like, I found myself thinking, I'm not sure he knows what he's talking about, but I don't know enough about it to argue his point. And it was really interesting. So I started delving into it and I got a few books and I was reading them.
I'm just laughing because to like beat someone, you decided to put four more years onto yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I said to myself, I'm really interested in this. And I always did want to do the whole psychology thing. I wanted to bring it somewhere, but I wasn't sure where. And I suddenly realised I was very interested in this. So I began exploring options. And that's what brought me to UL to do that master's in it. And if only, if nothing else, like sometimes, like I remember sometimes you see people tweeting things out and they don't mean anything by it. But it's just because sports psych is such a new field. They'll say, oh, that victory will be used as a template by sports psychologists for years to come. And you're like, no, it won't.
Relax, not that great.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, you don't know the story behind it, or you've no idea what kind of maladaptive things coaches might have been doing behind the scenes,
is
for example.
Like, is this like just people's obsession with the All Blacks and cleaning?
All that kind of stuff. Yeah, because if that was the case, wouldn't a clean dressing room, wouldn't we all be winning All-Ireland if we all had a clean dressing room?
Yeah.
No. It has its place and it worked well for them because somebody had the skills to go in and recognise this would help bring them along positively.
Yeah.
That doesn't work for everyone.
No.
You know, it's not that simple. Jeepers, if it was, I'd never have a job. Do you know?
And everyone would have an All-Ireland.
Exactly.
Poor Mayo wouldn't be crying every year, you know?
Would they?
Knowing they're like, they cleaned the bloody whole of Croke Park. And
yeah, exactly. Or they cleaned the other dressing room by accident or
something.
I don't know.
Stop. Oh, God. This is typical Galway, isn't it? The hate. Sorry to any Mayo person listening.
Oh, no. God bless Mayo. Do you know what? I would never begrudge those players in All-Ireland. They've worked so hard. And they're nice people.
I was up in Knock when they were playing Dublin in the replay.
Were they all there for the pray?
Yeah, they were all there at my event, but they were there like not to even see me, but just to stand in the church and pray.
The players?
No, like the whole fans, like the whole of Knock just came out. And then I came out and I saw this like Tree of Hope and it was dressed in a Mayo jersey. And I was like, oh, God,
wow.
Maybe that's what we need in Cork.
But it's not really working for Mayo either.
No, but
so maybe someone needs to cut down that tree.
Placebo effect, isn't it? Just hope for the best. How did you manage, I suppose, to get into journalism? Like what kind of, you said you were working with Radio Na Gaeltachta, wasn't it?
Yeah. I did my degree in Galway and I applied then for a higher diploma in applied communications.
Mm-hmm.
And that was done at Scoilga and I got in on that. And part of that was you had to get work experience. And I remember the well-meaning course coordinator got me work experience at the BBC in Belfast. And I had to go and say, look, dude, I can't afford to go to Belfast for a month unpaid. You want to get me somewhere closer to home? And he was like, you have to find it yourself. So I got it through RNG. Thomas McNamara, who was the head there at the time, I asked him, can I come in for a month to do my work experience? He said, yeah, sure. And then I kind of never really left.
Yeah.
So I started off reading kind of news headlines, and it was local news headlines, death notices. And then I was allowed out to cover a hurling game down a mobile phone somewhere in East Galway. Obviously, when you think about it, a bit of a test.
Yeah.
You know,
and recording like, into your phone.
Into my phone. You know, at a game, really, when you think about it, that the core Connemara listening audience probably didn't care that much about, you know, Climber Daly playing, you know, I think Glenamaddy or somebody in the hurling, you know, nobody would really care. Or Capitagle, one of those teams over there.
Did you turn into a Champions League final?
I probably did. Yeah. I was just delighted with myself that I didn't fall off air and that and that I had two little team sheets that I had to drop myself very quickly. And they're just coming back and forth with me for updates. And that kind of gave me the bug and kind of kicked off from there, really. And but I was on temporary contracts in RNG. You know, you'd have 3 months work and they'd be out for 1 month and that kind of thing. So then a permanent job opened up in Louth. So I got that. And that involved kind of doing a lot of video journalism. Actually based in Mayo a lot of the time. Did a lot of my work up in County Mayo and Galway. Started doing a bit of sports casting then. They finally let me in to do it. And eventually then kind of whirled my way through there for a few years and then somehow ended up working in RTÉ in Dublin and then somehow ended up being GA reporter for a summer, which is great, kind of working under Marty Morrissey and stuff.
Yeah.
And Donal McGrath, who's a Cork man, obviously. And then I was like, I did the sports psych masters. I did that documentary with Davy Fitz.
Yeah.
On Radio 1, which was great crack, highly stressful, but great crack. A little bit. And next thing you know, all those years have gone by then, you know, and all of a sudden you suddenly realise you're there for so long. And I wanted definitely to further the education and the whole medicine thing became an itch that I had to scratch. So I sat in an entry exam to try and get in. Took a bit of a gamble. I left my job because I left my job on the Wednesday, sat the exam on the Saturday and then had to wait till, that was March, and I had to wait till May to find out whether I got in or not.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So
because you didn't ring home and be like, I left my job to do an entry exam.
No, I mean, I remember when I'm ringing home mentioning to my mother, I'm kind of thinking of leaving and I got, oh. So I kind of stopped talking about it then. But I always knew I'd have the PhD in sports psych as a fallback if the whole medicine thing didn't work out. That was always a plan. So I was always going to go to college. I I was never going to leave anything without a plan to do something elsewhere.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I needed some money on the side to keep me ticking over and stuff like that. And I'm still convinced I only got into this medical degree on an afterthought because I got called much later than everybody else. So in the meantime, I began working with Off the Ball. Ger Gilroy gave me work. So I began crisscrossing the country for Off the Ball last year. And then I was doing some work for TG Cahad as well. And then over the winter months, I was one of the anchors for the Irish Sports Allianz League coverage. That was great fun. Myself and Damien Lawler were kind of doing a lot of that. And
you almost died. Aaron Kiernan was there to save you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. That was in Ballybuffet that night. Lots of strange things happened that night, but that's neither here nor there. But
that's Ballybuffet for you.
That's Ballybuffet for you. It does weird things to people. But I do remember that any match I was at, the weather was always atrocious and Damien Lawler always had, like, you know, at least it was dry. That's all I'm saying. Like, there was a game down in Tralee where Kerry were
Dublin.
Playing No Mayo.
Oh.
And it was atrocious. And we were doing two screening. So we did an hour long build up because Dublin, I think we were playing Tyrone in Croke
yes.
Park. And we had hurricanes, winds, rain, hailstones.
It was
in
a terrible
Tralee,
night.
And Damien Lawler was up with the stars shining brightly upon him up in Croke Park. So, you know, all I'm saying is, obviously, the weather gods decided they didn't like me during the months of January, February, March because I just got rained upon. But it was great fun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I do think sometimes people go, oh, media must be really glamorous. They don't see things
it's
like
not.
Aaron Kiernan holding the back of my jacket stop me from blowing away.
Yeah, yeah.
Or your hair whipping about the place or losing your notes or my notes disintegrating as happened to me Mayo the first night Mayo were playing Roscommon.
That was another bad night. Was that the night the camera had to come down?
Yes, that was the night we had to move the cameras down at half time. So we had to, and people were saying we can't see anything in the second half. We're like, well, the cameraman was going to blow away. So we had to move them. So that's the kind of stuff that happens in live sports broadcasting that people don't see. But somehow that's how I made my money and somehow I've made my career out of it 10 years later. If you'd ask me a pinpoint moment how it all happened, I don't know. Obviously, you'd have to say probably was RNG that started it all off. And
yeah.
Here I am at the illustrious heights of Red FM with you, Joanne.
I know. It's honestly, life takes you to such summits, honestly. I think actually I was reading an interview you did, I think it was with The Examiner, and you had said, I've been doing this for 10 years and I'm only getting recognised now.
Mm.
Now, I've had the same problem with the Irish Times. I've been doing it for 2 years now and only now people are saying to me, that's you. And I'm like, clearly that's me in the photo. How come it took people so long to acknowledge your whole existence?
Well, first of all, I'm not that important.
It's not like a bad way, but like if we see someone new on like a sports team, we're like, oh, who's that?
Yeah, a lot of it was behind the scenes. A lot of it was doing voiceovers where they wouldn't see your face. You'd be doing Sunday game voiceovers, things like that, where people would hear your voice, but they wouldn't know what you look like, which has its benefits.
Oh, you were the sultry tone, so.
That was me, yeah, the sultry tone. Ironically, actually, whenever I had a Sunday game match report going out, this is why I think media doesn't actually suit me as a living. I get very nervous. And I used to hate, they'd give me a game to cover. You know yourself, a game is 70 minutes plus, and I'd have maybe, if I was lucky, 2.5 minutes to condense the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd hate it because inevitably you'd leave something out.
Yeah.
Obviously. And something that people, rightfully so, would say, this is really important, why didn't you show it? But you're like, I have 2.5 minutes here, lads.
Yeah.
And I used to get up and leave the room. I couldn't watch my reports go out and I used to turn off Twitter because I couldn't deal with people saying, you said this wrong, you did that. And like, I used to cross every T and dot in the I. Like, I still do it. I will ring, if I'm doing any commentary or reports, I will ring up the PROs and I will look at the team sheet. Any unusual pronunciations there of names, anything like that.
Yeah.
Just because I don't want to get anything wrong. But even then, just the torture of it, I hate it. So it's probably a good thing I'm learning to be a doctor.
Oh, it's fine. I've never watched myself back either. I've never heard any of these podcasts back.
Have you not?
No, I trust my producers. I hope. No, I honestly have no interest in listening to myself back. I get too embarrassed whenever like they send me the clip. I'm like, no, yeah, it's grand.
Yeah, I can't.
No, I can't. I've never seen No Limbs, No Limits.
Have you not?
No, people tell me it's worth it. I'm like,
it is.
I trust you.
Watch.
But I trust you.
It's a good watch.
I left, literally the premiere was on. The lights went down. I went to the toilet, stayed there for an hour and a half, and I came back out.
Did anybody even notice you were gone?
No. My friend, all right, looked, she was like, I didn't hear any nachos. And I was like, you know, I was like, yeah, I was in the bathroom.
No, you were rustling in the bathroom, obviously.
Yeah, I was just having my nachos in the bathroom. But yeah, I was mortified. Yeah, no, God, excuse me. I don't know. I think you think you're funny. Like, I think I'm funny. And then I see myself, I'm like, that's not funny, Joanne. Never say that
I live
again.
In fear of like making a joke and it dying.
Yeah.
At least if I don't know it died.
Even doing public speaking, like, I mean, I had one with a bunch of kids and I said something about my brothers wrestling me and they were like, huh? And I was like, oh my God, I'm never coming back here. Never in my whole entire life. But like, how come, like, you don't listen to yourself back? But I remember you said that you get like, it's becoming a bit more intense now, like the focus on you and you're getting a bit more abuse. Because even I find stuff is coming in saying, get off the airwaves or do this and do that. You have the same problem.
Yeah, and
doesn't bother me. My brothers frame it.
Oh. Because these people are saying things they can't say.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't bother me. The one thing I've noticed is that it's gotten more violent.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing, and I think that's indicative of society in general. It's not abuse against female sportscasters or any broadcasters or anything like that. Mm. No, for the most part, it's grand. And the thing is, you have to remember that for every person who says a mean thing or a horrible thing, there's 10 or 20 people who'll come along and say you did a great job. And that's the good thing and the terrible thing about our jobs, is that there's not many jobs out there where people come up to you and say you did a great job.
Mm.
But at the same time, if you have a bad day at the office, and we all do at times, you make a mistake or you're just not at the races for whatever reason, most people don't know in the real world. They just go home and say, geez, that was a terrible day. They have a cup of tea or a glass of wine. They go to bed and tomorrow's a new day. In broadcasting, you don't get that luxury. You're pummeled left, right and centre.
Yeah.
And that's something that perhaps people don't realise what they're doing when they are throwing stuff like that at you.
Yeah.
But even that, I don't mind. I genuinely don't mind when somebody says that was a stupid question, because sometimes I do ask stupid questions.
Yeah.
Especially because, but again, you see, I think it's a lack of understanding. They don't realise you're under pressure. You've got people screaming at base wanting this audio or this interview. You have maybe a minute with the manager if you're lucky, and they're coming at you and you're ready to go, and you've no time to research. You've no time to read up. You know, you're just automatically reacting to something you saw in the game, and sometimes you mightn't choose your words to be the most appropriate the way they should be.
Yeah.
So,
because you've had that not personally had it twice, but you had Andy McIntyre last year and you had Davey Fitz this year. You had the immediate, I suppose, reaction. You had like the most human managerial experience that probably we've ever seen at a GA. Like Andy McIntyre literally cried in front of you.
He did. Oh, God love him.
Was your sports psychology going 90 there?
Well, maybe if I had the time to actually talk to him properly, but I was in a press pack with loads of people who possibly weren't that comfortable with seeing a man crying. Again, we come back to the beginning of our conversation and crying men. The older men of the group kind of didn't know how to deal with it, whereas I actually would have let him
have
process it and have a moment, because it was such a big thing. And Meath were not expected to win that game. They were going in as complete no-hopers, and they played brilliantly. And then to get to that point where there was a free, they weren't given the free, and it was a kickable free.
Yeah.
And that could have changed things completely for them. Mm. And then that kind of, imagine that kind of emotion. Imagine the pressure Andy McAtee must have been under for months coming up to that game.
Yeah.
And then to see it all disintegrate like that, and that was the summer over. That was early June last year. Now, look how things are going now. Meath have improved immensely since then. They really kicked on. But yeah, like sport, I always say it's the least important thing in the world and the most important thing in the world at times. And at that moment, it was the most important thing to him. But I'm sure once he went home after a few hours or a few days and processed it, he probably did realise, I'm probably putting words in his mouth now, but that it was just sport.
Yeah.
And these things happen. Was it fair? No. Should it have happened? I don't think so. But chances are, if they'd even kicked that free, I can't even remember now, would have gone to extra time again, or would it have been a replay? Would they have won out over Tyrone eventually? Probably not.
Yeah.
But it was the inequity of it, and I think the feeling of huge injustice that was done to him.
Yeah.
It was just really, really cruel. And that's the trouble with sport, isn't it? It's cruel at times.
Is that something we're kind of obsessed with now? Because I remember under Martin O'Neill, whenever Ireland would lose or something dramatic would happen, Tony O'Donoghue would always run up to James McLean because you knew James McLean was going to say something.
Yeah.
Do you think that's something we're dying to see now? Like something that we're just like, oh, thank God James McLean is expressing emotion. You know, thank God he's not giving out, you know, like Martin O'Neill. Is that something, and is that a pressure on you to bring us that?
Not really. I mean, I think we'd be putting a lot of importance on ourselves if we thought that was. I think my job is, I always think like a good reporter should be like a good referee, and we shouldn't be noticed.
Yeah.
Like the only time people are talking about a referee is when they've made a mistake. And same way, I think when people are talking about reporters, they shouldn't really be talking about you, I think.
Yeah.
You know, so I wouldn't take it as pressure. You'll automatically go toward the player or the manager who will give you more, because I think that's what the fans want. That, and I always take the, if I was sitting at home, who do I want to listen to? What do I want to hear?
Mm.
I don't want to hear somebody giving out cliches. It's boring. And I think it's doing an injustice to people who pay money, good money, to follow these teams and stuff like that, to give out the whole, we take every day as it comes and all this kind of stuff. That drives me insane.
Do you think now that there's a disconnect though, because that's happening more and more?
I think it's getting to that point.
Yeah.
Some teams manage it better than others. I think a lot of it comes down to fear, and fear of giving the other side ammunition, which I keep trying to tell people, you know, I know this from working in sports psychology, it's complete bull.
Yeah.
There is no study in the world that proves that if I say something about Joanne's team, they hang it up in your dressing room wall, that you're going to beat me because of that. It doesn't work that way. Again, a bit like cleaning the dressing rooms.
Yeah.
If it was that simple, sure, wouldn't we all be doing it?
Because I remember we had Tracy Kennedy in here, and I remember her saying that even though she had a good relationship with a lot of media officers, that the person who came in in after her didn't, because they had something taken out of context. Mm. I remember her saying that that like shut down nearly a lot of media interaction, which she was really disappointed by because she felt she worked so hard.
Yeah.
So do you ever find like when you go to like say a Dublin game and Jim Gavin comes out and he's like, oh, I only have 5 minutes, and he whips off a load of cliches, do you think that a load of fans are just like, you know what, enough, like I'm paying money to follow this team and they're not giving me much?
Obviously
not targeting Jim Gavin, like, you know.
Possibly. Now again, you see, with Jim Gavin, I really like Jim Gavin. I think he's a gentleman. Mm. I've never had a cross word with him. I'm sure at times he must be thinking, this question's really stupid, I'm bored, I'm tired, I want to have a drink of water, you know, I want to go off celebrate with my team. And he's always a gentleman, which, you know, you can't always say about everyone.
No.
In all walks of life. And I just think, a bit like Brian Cody, people say, is Jim Gavin really that boring? He's not boring. He's just, this is his thing.
Yeah.
Methodology, systems, focus. This is Jim Gavin's thing. That's what he's passionate about. Get Jim Gavin talking about airplanes and he will tell you great stuff.
He asked me, I met him once and we were talking about football and he made a joke about Cork. Like, no joke, he literally said, what's wrong with Cork?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I don't know. And he was like, oh, we're going to have to bring you up to Dublin. And I was like, ha, 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 yeah, oh my God, Jim Gavin's making jokes. And then he turned a little second and he was like, where does your chair go on the plane as interest? And I was like, oh. And next thing we started talking about planes and a whole new Jim Gavin unravelled in front of me. And I was like, this is so bizarre.
Yeah, you see the passion in him because that's his thing.
Yeah.
And we all have our things. Like for me, Supermax. I will talk eloquently about Supermax for hours.
Are you sponsored yet?
No. Can you believe that?
Pat
I'm not.
Mac. What are you at?
Why I don't have a car shaped like a snack box, I don't know. But I mean, people say this about Jim Gavin and they're like, you know, he must be really boring. He's not. But he's guarded and I understand that. Same as people say, Brian Cody, what's the secret? I'm like, there is no secret. It's just Brian Cody's life is hurling.
Yeah.
That's all it is. There's no, it's all very black and white with Brian. Every decision he makes is based upon what he thinks is best for hurling. There's no magic to it. It's just Brian Cody happened to be lucky enough to be in a county where no other sport is played and they had the best crop of hurlers ever seen ever in anyone's lifetime in one go. And he was a primary school teacher, so he had plenty of time to be adding it all together and he loved it.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
Because I always find actually that whenever I go to do women's matches, I always get like the most appreciation for some unknown reason. And I go to a men's match and they're like, oh my God, this journalist is asking me too many questions.
Yeah.
It's like the most bizarre thing ever. And I'm always like, man,
yeah.
You know, if only people could see this side of it, you know, because I'm telling people, oh yeah, like if I go to a Cork ladies football game, they're like, thanks very much. Thanks so much. Do you find, I don't know if you do ladies matches, but do you find that there's
I find with ladies' matches and any code, they're a bit more appreciative of media coverage because they understand it's important to get their message out there. And they're probably still not used to sometimes a journalist showing up.
Yeah.
And when you do, it's nearly a pleasant surprise that somebody wants to talk to them, which is quite sad.
It is.
Now it's changing. Definitely changing. They're getting much more coverage. But I think as well, to be fair, like even the younger teams, like I'm thinking like of the Limerick Hurlers, for example. Whenever you interview them, whenever you're done talking to them, you'll always get a thank you very much. You know, they're very polite young people. And I say young now because I'm at the age now where most intercounty hurlers and footballers are in around the same age or getting younger. You know, I'm at that stage now, you know, and some of them, like the Limerick Hurlers, I'm Keane Lynch, always a nice laddie is what I'd say because to me, he's 12 years old. You know, that kind of way. And there's definitely most people understand that we're there doing a job and that we're there to be the conduit between them and their fans.
Mm.
So it's up to them to put their best foot forward. And it's funny enough, I think the more successful a team is, the less guarded they become in that, like, Johnny Cooper is a great interviewee.
Yeah.
And when you think about it, like, how many All-Ireland medals does he have jangling in his pocket? And he doesn't really hide anything, but he's very, very good at talking a lot, saying lots of interesting things, but nothing that will cause him trouble because... Mm. As somebody once said to me, like, if you don't trust a man to go out and do an interview with a journalist, how can you trust him in the middle of Croke Park
to do
the job? You know, so I do think managers who put like muzzles on their players are doing their players an injustice and also doing their county an injustice and their fans, because the fans want to hear these people. You need to connect with people to care about them.
Yeah.
And that was why I think ladies' sports and women's sports wasn't getting the coverage it deserved. We weren't hearing from them and then there was a disconnect. Whereas in Cork, the Cork ladies' football brand is so strong, as is Camogie, and therefore Cork people had a connection with them, so they followed them.
But still, I think even Reno came in and she was saying that it wasn't until 2014 that they... like saw their fame in air quotes, you know, that people only started kind of connecting towards them. And I think she was saying something to do with like social media, I suppose, was a big help.
Yep.
But more importantly, that the book that was released, Relentless, that was a big game changer, like, for her. And I remember just kind of when she was saying, like, people understood what we were doing behind the scenes. Because we all know Graham Kenty used to train as ourself. We all knew Noel O'Leary was really passionate about the game. But no one knew that Rena Buckley was. No one knew that Breach Corker, you know, was a bit mental. And I suppose that's kind of what we're more looking for maybe now, more so in women's sports, just a more...
I don't know. We want to know more about
them. We're trying to connect, I suppose, a little bit more.
And they're so much more accessible. So if you, like, if you're from County Galway, for example, and you want to, you want your kids to meet inter-county footballers, you might bring them to a ladies' football game now and you show them, look at Tracy Leonard, look how strong she is, look what an amazing captain she is. And because the crowds are smaller, they have more time to meet with kids and chat with them and take photos and stuff like that. And then that creates a connection. And now that media are actually covering them, you're hearing their names more and more. And like you said, that book, that shows exactly, it's not that the football was bad, it's not that anybody wasn't interested, it was just that nobody knew about it until somebody put a book in somebody's hand and said, read this.
Yeah.
And isn't that awful that it had to go to that point?
It did.
But that would be the case of all sports if we weren't covering them. So when people say, oh, people aren't interested, if they were, we'd be hearing about it. No, that's media being lazy and it's up to us to be less lazy, which I think is happening.
Yeah.
We're certainly speeding up, but we're nowhere near where we should be.
It's kind of hard as well because I think not a lot of people are available. You know, I remember like getting a phone call from my boss and he was like, oh, I would send you to this game, but I have to send someone else to another game. And there was like too much all over the place. I was like, I'll cover it. I don't care. I think we kind of have to be a bit more willing, but at the same time, it is a job, you know, and I think a lot of people do forget at the end of the day, I have to get paid, you know.
This is the thing, and this is something that grinds my gears big time, because we have devalued so many industries in this country and in the world, where it's the point now where people don't get permanent jobs in media anymore. We saw newspapers shutting down there during the week in Ireland. We're seeing radio stations constantly having to cut to keep their heads above water. We're seeing the media contract. And then people see sport media in particular as something that can be disposable or dispensable or not paid for. And then you see people giving advice saying, oh, work for free. I mean, no.
No.
You need to value yourself. Is there any other industry in the world where you'd be told, oh, you want to be a chef? Go work in the kitchen for free for 3 months and then they'll give you a job. No. They'll take your free labour because they're thinking, great, we're really short staffed. Are they going to value you? No.
No.
And like, to be in media, you tend to have a degree.
Yeah.
You know, post-grad, this, that and the other. And then telling people to work for free. So what you're doing is you're cutting out people who might be able to afford to work for free. Like, say, for example, that time way back when they wanted me to go to the BBC for a month, I didn't have the money to go to Belfast.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if that was, that could have been easily the end? They could have said, OK, fine, you can't do the course then.
Yeah.
For example. So, like, I always tell people when they're starting out, get your experience, use student radio, use things like that to build up your air miles, so to speak. But cut a deal. If you're going into a local radio station or a local paper, that you say, they might say, we don't have the budget to pay for you to go out. And you say, OK, fine. But how about I do go out? But if you use my content, then you pay me.
Yeah.
And that's win-win then.
Yeah.
Because if they think it's good enough to publish or if they think it's good enough to broadcast, that means they think you're worth being paid.
Yeah.
And that's something I always try to hammer home to young people, because I find media in particular can really, really, really take advantage of younger people. And also then when somebody's coming in doing that kind of stuff, they're devaluing themselves, which is doing themselves huge personal and professional damage. But they're also devaluing the industry, because what happens then is somebody else who might have been paid doesn't get the call, like you said.
Yeah.
And that's so important. And this will only happen when consumers appreciate the value of media, and not everything can come for free off Twitter.
I was just going to say, you like when you see online, oh, I can't read, it's behind a paywall. A part of me is like, just pay the €2. You'll pay the €2 for the paper.
Yeah.
Like, you won't just pay the €2 to read the damn article
you're
dying to read.
You're sitting in Starbucks, probably after paying nearly €5 on a fancy pants coffee, and you've, for some reason, you're not going to pay that €2 to get the Sunday Business Post, for example, or whatever behind the paywall.
Yeah.
Which is quality journalism.
Mm-hmm.
I do wonder.
Yeah,
I just don't understand why. And this is where I suppose media companies went wrong. I suppose they didn't know any different at the time. Social media came along so quickly. They didn't know how to manage it. And when everything was being published for free online, they were thinking, we need to be getting hits onto our website.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably damaged it for themselves. And now they're trying to roll back a bit. But I do sometimes wonder, like, I pay subscriptions to things that I think are worth it.
Yeah.
I'd see it's my bit. And I look at it as a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And if you can't do that, if you can't value it to the same level as you value your Starbucks, well, then you get the content you deserve.
Yeah. It's true. I remember my brother texted me, one of my articles was behind a paywall, and he was like, who do you think you are, mate? And I was like, I'm a quality journalist now, apparently. And he was like, nah, I'm over it, Joanne. I'm over it. I'm never reading your articles again. But it's actually kind of sad, because even as he was saying to me that he logs on and he would like go onto the iPad, log on again. And it's like hits now that we're kind of obsessed with. And that's why clickbait is getting more and more, and people are getting really frustrated because, you know, this is what Prince Harry said to Meghan Markle before the wedding, even though it's nothing.
Yeah,
you know,
I'll still click into it though.
Oh yeah, I'm the same.
I love Prince Harry and Meghan Markle.
This is the dress you need to be wearing for the summer. Like, is it?
Yeah. Let me find out, and I go, oh, that's a horrible dress.
Yeah, and then I get really annoyed by it. I'm like, god damn, I could have been clicking on something really, really important, you know. Thanks very much for listening to part one of my interview with Mara Trasanigalig, where we talk about growing up in Galway, becoming a sports journalist and everything in between. Tune in next week for episode 6, where we talk about 20 by 20, what it's like to be a woman in sport, and everything else in between. Cheerio.
The Big Red Bench. Game on. Saturday and Sunday from 6 p.m.